Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
138. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. Steve, do you have a short answer to why do you think President Trump fired James Comey?
Well, I think there's more to it than what they're saying. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah. I think that's wise and true. And, you know, maybe it's both. You know, maybe it's both. Maybe it is that they were dismayed by his handling of the email investigation, and maybe they also didn't like the heat, and so they decided to dismiss him and wait until they can put their own guy in to head the FBI. And
are you offering your services? Are you available?
No. That's not a job I want or could do. It strikes me as the FBI, while I'm ethical, I'm situationally ethical, so there's that. But also, I suspect that the director of the FBI has to be pretty organized. He can't be going, so which is who is the guy? That would be me. I'd be giving a briefing. I go, so who is... And that would be bad.
I think you're giving yourself a compliment there, because you'd be more like, it's Wednesday, right?
Lauren Marks is in our studio, not to talk about that, but to talk about her own remarkable journey. Lauren, welcome to WGN. How are you this afternoon?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Your book is The Year a Brain Injury Changed My Language and Life. Actually, that's the subtitle. The title is A Stitch of Time. You had called an aneurysm? Is that what led to your, what happened?
Well, an aneurysm ruptured in my brain when I was 27, so that was totally unexpected.
Like on the spot, you're at a bar, you're about to sing karaoke with some friends.
I was on stage singing the song out.
And boom, you just dropped.
And so unfortunately for me, it was the sort of not the kind of song you want to be doing when you say it to be your song, so, like swan song. It was a total eclipse of the heart. I was in the middle of singing that song.
I actually wondered if that isn't why your brain said, nope, we're out. Total Eclipse of the Heart is not a song that should be sung in most bars anyway.
No.
So you have this incident where you, next thing you know, you're waking up, somebody slapping you in the face saying, hey, come to. Mm-hmm. Keep going.
Well, I mean, I was there for the Fringe Festival. I was touring. I was an actor, a director, and a PhD student in New York. But basically after I woke up, after some sort of gloaming moments, I'd had emergency brain surgery. I mean, it was over, and that's what people were telling me. So I just tried to adjust to whatever that meant, but it didn't quite seem correct. It didn't seem like that had really happened, because I had looked in the mirror and I didn't have a scar. I didn't quite understand how you'd have a brain surgery without, you know, going through the head. I later learned the details of a neuroradiological procedure, but more importantly, the thing that had changed the most was I had lost my language, speaking, reading, writing, and my inner language. I think the inner monologue was sort of the most pronounced element.
Can you describe that? Because you're doing the book so well. What do you mean, I've lost my inner language?
Well, I call
my
it
inner monologue.
Exactly. I call it the quiet in the book, because, and I want to say it's important to emphasize that I didn't call it anything at the time, because I didn't name things in this way. I just knew something was different. I didn't know what was different. And it seemed to me that that what it could have been was, it just took a long time. Basically, I had to get my language back to know that it had been missing.
Well, your outer language was lost, too. That is, you suffer a brain injury that now renders you sort of like an Oliver Sacks patient, unable to recognize words or language. You weren't able to speak well. And when you were speaking, you thought you'd be doing a great job.
Exactly.
And evidently on the other end was gibberish. They didn't know what you were saying at all.
Yeah, I'm told I had about 40 or 50 words. But, you know, when people were looking at me perplexed, I was saying, this is really their problem, isn't it? You know.
Well, that said, you also had trouble reading their reactions. You sort of lost the ability to intuit people's facial expressions.
Yeah, there was like a blunt tool with that. Like I knew someone who was a friend from a foe. I knew someone who was helpful and someone who was not helpful. I knew who my mother was. I knew that my friends were my friends. It wasn't pure amnesia, but yeah, it was, everything was really dampened.
Well, at that time, after the injury and after the surgery, right?
Yeah.
If I had said to you, hello, how are you? And what did you think of Donald Trump today or something? Would you understand what I was saying?
It's so funny that you mentioned that specifically because I was an American in Scotland and they kept asking me about Gordon Brown and he'd just become the prime minister. So even if I wasn't super injured, I wouldn't have been able to answer what they were saying. They're like, who's the prime minister? And I was like, apparently I was just trying to say not Blair, but that wasn't coming out either. So it just, I would have known if someone said the president is in trouble and the president at the time, you know, I would have known who that was and I would be able to access it, but I'd need to have these prompts. So I wasn't having that automatic recall that we all have in regular conversation.
So you were able to eventually recover that ability, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The inner monologue that you said you lost was, you said when you get up in the day and you say, okay, now I'm going to brush my teeth and make coffee or whatever, there's a sort of conversation we have with ourselves, a will to do it and kind of an inner monologue.
Yeah.
And that was lost on you. But would you still know to brush your teeth and make coffee in the morning?
Well, I was in the hospital for a while, so I didn't make the coffee. I think someone told me to brush my teeth. I was very, very present focused. And that's sort of the element that surprises people the most, that I wasn't upset. I mean, that's what is probably the most unusual aspect to the brain injury.
Yeah, you're like my teenage sons. They were only thinking in the moment.
Well, yeah. And I wonder how much of that was, you know, other parts of the brain injury, because it's a hemorrhage. So it can attach to any part of the brain can be attacked. But in that floodplain, basically. But I was absolutely content because I didn't really have a lot of interest in my past and future. And I feel like that language might have been part of that, you know, that without having to say, what am I doing in a hospital? Am I in trouble? How long am I going to be here? Will I be able to get back to my PhD program? Will I be able to act again? None of that was running. So I had impressions. And when things happened that were unpleasant, I understood that to be unpleasant. But it just passed so quickly. It was as if it didn't happen at all.
This will seem insensitive, but was that kind of a nice place to be?
Yeah, I don't think it's insensitive at all.
Well, I mean, you suffered a brain injury, and this is a malfunction of your brain, but when you describe the quiet in capital letters as though it's a thing, a person, or a place, I think, I kind of like the quiet.
I do too. And so did I at the time, and that was the surprise. I mean, it was so utterly encompassing and so comfortable.
Can you tell us what it was like then when you're in the hospital and you have your first Diet Pepsi?
That's so funny. All my suite mates was in a suite of four, and I was one of those four. And all of them were Scottish, and all of them had very thick brogues. But one of them was willing to, you know, walk me down to where the Coke machine was. And I was just so enthralled, like in a way that you wouldn't really think a trip to the Pepsi machine was really that important. But I mean, every step was just sort of magical, every little moment. And when I, you know, had this like popped fizz, I mean, I didn't bring any money. I didn't know what I was supposed to do there. And she bought it for me. And as soon as I had it in my mouth, it felt volcanically sweet. It felt like I'd never had that impression before, ever. It was really, I mean, and that was sort of mirrored in by almost all of my daily activities, getting dressed, brushing my teeth. You know, I did love having my family there. I did love my friends, but I was kind of more comfortable when they weren't there.
Look at you. You sound and seem completely recovered from all of this. What was the lesson you learned, or what was the point of your telling this story?
Oh, that's a pretty big question. Why? I mean, I can tell you why I was working on it and why I was compelled to tell it. And that's changed now, why I wanted to put it out in the world. But I mean, I was producing these journal entries even when my language was very, very fractured. So I didn't know how bad it was. And at some point I had this awareness, like I looked into my own journal entries thinking I had produced something in there that was not there. And that if anyone else looked into these journal entries, they wouldn't have been able to make sense of that.
It was sometimes a nonsensical jumble of words.
Absolutely.
To an outsider. Even
exactly.
To you, yeah.
But how funny to realize that later, to look in thinking you're going to find like, oh, a journal that you understand and it chronicles your experiences. But looking to my own journal and say, this is gobbledygook. And I kind of know what this is referencing because I know what that one thing is. But no one else would. And so that was first terrifying, to tell you the truth, that moment in which I saw that it really had been very, very bad. Because then I wondered, what does it mean now? Because at the time, I had my inner monologue restored at that point, and knowing the sort of magnitude of that situation was suddenly horrifying. Because if I'm like that then, what was I now, and what will I be in the future? But the second right after, it was super curious, you know, like, well, that's weird, and that's interesting. So then I just started feeling like this was a sort of worthy endeavor to sort of plumb that, my more than one mind, you know, that I woke up with a different brain, and myself became a moving target.
So do you like this version? Do you remember the old version of you? And do you like this newer version of you?
I think there are pros and cons to all of these versions. I have to say that the quiet is not as readily accessible as it was in those moments. It is something that I can reflect on in a purposeful way. I can sort of go into a meditative element.
But pardon me if I may, do you think you still like the same things? Do you still have the same affection for the boyfriend? Do you have the same relationship with your parents? Do you like Diet Pepsi more now than you used to? Are you the same person that you were?
Let's address the Diet Pepsi first. No, I didn't feel a lot of that stuff becomes more subdued and other things become more enriched. I'm very grateful that the people who were there for me, because I did not have the same emotional intention with them for a while for lots of reasons. So our language and our interactions become so much more enriched by the watching them, watching me transform into something slightly different. Now that being said, I'm not the same person who just woke up from the aneurysm either. So, I mean, in some ways, 10 years later, I think there's a lot of similarities to now as I was before. I just think I have a little more positivity than I had before the rupture. I think because, like, what are you supposed to do? Like, I think I had a lot of 27-year-olds, with some ambition. Like, I've got to get these things done. If it's not working, it's my fault. Why is it not working? And how can I change this? Maybe I can't change this. Maybe happiness is not the point, is something I thought to myself at some point, wrote down.
I think there's some insight into your book, too, that maybe you don't realize. Do you want to know what it is?
Tell me.
After this. On and off the air, we're talking with Lauren Marks. Her book is A Stitch of Time. The Year a Brain Injury Changed My Language and Life. If you are a fan of Oliver Sacks, imagine if all of his patients wrote really well, fascinating books. This is along those lines. She is going to be appearing this evening in Logan Square. It's City Lit. Reading from the book tonight?
Yeah.
You're able to read from your book as well?
I can. Please come. Please come.
I only asked because off the air you were saying, well, there's some vestiges of having had an aneurysm, and you're such a language-specific person, but the way you write and encompass words now or encounter words is different.
Yeah, absolutely.
See, there, I just did it. I said encompass instead of encounter. They're similarly sized words. I was describing to her how I have some weird word issues. And I wonder if maybe I shouldn't have a brain scan, too. Your thoughts?
Well, I call those circumlocutions,
yes.
You know.
I do spoonerisms, too.
Yeah, and I think a certain number of those things do just happen to everybody. But when it becomes a reliable pattern, and I mean, like, there's not a day that goes by. In fact, there's not an hour that goes by when I don't produce something in writing that is not correct. I mean, there's like three elements, perhaps. Like, I leave out pronouns or I replace them. If I'm writing about myself, I sometimes wrote he or she or even they. Like,
literally, your fingers do that. And
yeah.
You had no intention of doing that.
And it's really common, actually. I've talked to many other people who have aphasia who say the same. The other is what I call phonemic paraphasias, which things that sound the same but don't mean the same thing at all, like soul and sore, cad and cat.
You'll
fly
write one
and
word,
die, even,
knowing,
you know,
like, right, and you're like, why did that word appear in front of me? I just wrote it, but I didn't intend to put that down at all.
Yeah, but the speed of writing is a little faster for me than for speaking. So, like, I can put down a full paragraph or two paragraphs, maybe an email, maybe some just free writing, but then I have to highlight the entire area. And a lot of computers are set up this way to have text-to-speech. So then listen to everything and see what I left out and what I am wrong. Like, my editing brain is still able to get it. I still hear the misses and the misfires, but that doesn't stop me from producing them.
You're a lovely writer, and your story is compelling. I think one thing that maybe you can't appreciate, because you're only you, but as a third person reading what you wrote, I think your sort of description of and pursuit of the quiet, your description of the quiet, you'll read about it in the book, I think is just really interesting. And the fact that we all have this inner monologue that I think we take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think about who we are and how we are addressing ourselves, we would benefit if we thought, instead of worrying about all the time what other people are saying to me, what am I saying to me,
mm-hmm.
would be really resourceful.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I miss that sort of placid quiet, as I talk about it in the book. But I also want to say, in praise of inner monologue too, I mean, like, it is very successful to be able to talk to yourself. It's a very adult thing to do, to be able to plan. Like, language is at its very best for me when it's not right here and not right now. So you can be in a room with someone you love listening to opera, and you can have an amazing experience together, right? You don't need the words to say, wasn't that an amazing experience? That's present tense is good. You can do that with somebody else. But if you want to collaborate or make something in the future, like, you need the language. If you need to reflect on something that was impersonal, or the person wasn't with you at that moment, whatever it is, you have to access it with language. And that's what the inner monologue can be so successful with. It's like, it can be incredibly pernicious as well. It can run you on the hamster wheel of despair if you let it.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think that it can be a great thing too.
Lauren Marks, A Stitch of Time is her book. It's a Simon & Schuster hardback. She's going to be out at Logan Square tonight at City Lit. Nice to meet you.
7 p.m. Come on out.